I'm going to share about evolution today here. The first part is things that Hugh has talked about and I've talked about here in the class, and then about halfway through it will transition to things that I don't think has ever been taught in this class. Fuzz Rana teaches on it occasionally, and so that's kind of Fuzz's ministry, not Hugh's ministry, and so hopefully you'll find it interesting. I talked about that obviously through growing up in the public education system. You know, I believe in evolution and the evidences that they gave me when I was in high school and college. But the more research, you know, that I have done and the more reading I've done and even making this slideshow gave me even more, obviously, assurances that the theory of evolution really is in crisis, even though there's a lot of people still trying to prop it up and hold it.
But last week you talked about the type of evolution.
And I just told you that I'm going to get that in the second half of my slide. And so the first half of my slide here, so unless you really don't understand something and you have a question, ask a question, but try and hold comments to a minimum for the first 10 minutes so that we can get to the newer stuff. And when I get to the newer stuff, then I'll take any questions or any comments because it's going to be stuff that hasn't been presented in this class before. That make sense?
Yeah.
So first one, yes.
Can you make an announcement about Skeptics Forum and also Casa de Dios?
Well, we didn't do CASAS, but John actually did. I already did that. So why don't you tell us about CASA, because I don't have the latest information.
Casa de Dios is October 17th, and whatever the Friday, or that's a Friday, Saturday, that's 2 days.
Right.
And I'm on a personal mission to try to get some people that have never been Casa de Dios. So next week I'll make a more expansive announcement about it.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot, and I think we've had testimony here about people that have gone. You know, my kids went, my wife and I went, obviously, and went with Ross, and it was he cocked me into it, and it was a great experience that we went the second time. You know, it's good when you go the second time.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun. It's an incredible experience that words don't even do justice to the emotions and the experience is really just the way to do it, obviously. Yeah.
Like when you became a Christian and you realized, I just didn't get it.
Yeah, something like that. It's an incredible experience to be able to give to people that have nothing, obviously. Start with just definition. If you use the simplest definition, then I can say I believe in evolution. Simplest, just change over time. Or when you talk about biological functions, obviously, then talking about how biology gets from simple to complex. And if we look at the fossil record, we see, yes, that obviously life over time has gone from simple to very complex. Hugh used the word evolution to talk about the universe, because the universe has changed over time. Societies have changed. Life has changed. So in the simplest definition, evolution, and this makes obviously you have to define words. So I've heard, you know, Christians and non-Christians arguing over evolution, and obviously I've realized that they were using the same words, but their definitions were different. And so when you're discussing with somebody, you have to make sure that you define your words properly. This is from Darwin's own words. And so he was the one that came up with the first theory of evolution. He came up with that from going to the Galapagos Islands and looking how the life on the various islands that were isolated had changed over time. In particular, obviously studied the finches and saw that their beaks grew or small, shrunk based on the food supply that was available. If a bird had to crack large nuts to survive, the little teeny finch with a little beak couldn't make it, but a finch with a larger beak could, and then vice versa. And so it was other animals on those islands that had gave him this theory also. But that's what he started with and what he saw. People actually obviously, because a lot of times they talk about neo-Darwinism, because obviously Darwin obviously didn't propose as aggressive of evolution that most universities are teaching now today.
Steve,
if you have a question, you can ask it. But this is my part where I do not take comments because I want to get to the new part, okay?
Okay?
We could get off on all kind of tangents here, obviously, and I want to do this. This is just a basic review because this stuff has all been taught in this class before. So it's just basic review. People that believe in evolution, and Hugh's talked a lot about this, is point to things like bacteria. And we have bacteria that's become resistant to antibiotic. It's a big problem in our hospitals. I've had friends that almost died because they went to a hospital for one thing, came down with one of these strains of bacteria that's totally resistant to every known antibiotic out there and almost died. What Hugh has found out, and hopefully the doctors get that, is that if you remove that antibiotic from the environment for 40, 50 years, because the evolution is not permanent, the population of bacteria within 50 years will go back and be non-resistant, and all those drugs, that drug could come back and be used again. So hopefully our doctors clue in and take some antibiotics off the market for 50 years and reintroduce them. And so this obviously, what they point out as the evidence of evolution and change, in theory obviously doesn't count, because the change is not permanent, right? You know that would tell us obviously that if the environment changed, then the animal should go back the way it was. We don't see that in nature, and they don't point that out. That the reverse effect is there. It's not a permanent change; it's a temporary change. And we can make sense of that. Obviously, if you had some dictator in some country that killed every redheaded person, you know, every year, there's not going to be redheaded people in the country anymore. You know, I mean, it says you don't have to be a scientist to figure that out. You know. When people talk about evolution, they're usually talking about macroevolution, talking about obviously how we had the simplest form of bacteria here on the planet. Hughes talked a lot about those early bacteria, so I'm not going to do that. But very quickly, that bacteria, you know, and other forms of algae, photosynthetic algae, quickly became multicellular organisms that branched out very quickly into lots of different things. We're going to look a little bit more into the fossil record to talk about that. But then when we talk about evolution, that's what most people are talking about. The problem, obviously, with the people that believe in evolution, they will obviously point to the bacteria and say, well, this bacteria mutated and changed it to this resistance, so that proves all of evolution is true. And is that correct? And the answer, of course, is going to be, well, you'll find out. So what causes animals to change? What caused that bacteria to change? What caused other things to change? There's other driving factors here, but these are the main ones: natural selection and mutation. We've had people in this class claim, well, yeah, evolution's true because, you know, animals mutate and there is natural selection. And within bacteria, they also can exchange genes, which is why they obviously have a little bit at edge on changing more than other animals. So natural selection, if you're not familiar with it, obviously, we talk about the fittest of the survival of the fittest, but this would be the dictionary definition of just that particular traits are going to be passed on to offspring. So offspring that are not able to adapt and live in their environment are going to die, and the ones that have adaptations or features like the beaks and the fins to survive will survive. And so natural selection is going to determine what offsprings are going to live on, and those ones that live on are going to reproduce, and you can get change over time. And we're going to talk about this process a little bit more. However, this is the same thing. I use redheads. Beetles is better. We don't want to kill any redheads. So if a crow obviously likes green beetles, it only eats green beetles, and there's lots of crows in that neighborhood, obviously the green beetles are all going to disappear. But even the people that believe in evolution will say it doesn't create lungs or eyes or hearts or all these other wonderful things we see in nature. Why I don't believe natural selection obviously can really produce new species, and I've talked about this a lot, is that we've been breeding dogs for, this is a dictionary obviously, or the encyclopedia would say 33,000 years. I think it's beyond that obviously, because man very quickly learned to domesticate wolves, be able to use them to protect their livestock or just to protect their family, you know, to have a dog to be able to bark obviously and warn you that there's a lion in your neighborhood or something like that. People have been breeding dogs for thousands and thousands of years. And what we found is when you breed that dog to be larger, the dog lifespan drastically decreases. So a wolf, obviously, in captivity, lived maybe 18, 19, 20 years. You take that same wolf and you breed him just to a husky, and if you look at the husky picture here, which is right above the word thousands, it looks very similar to wolf, but even there now, you've trimmed off about 15 years out of his life. You want your dog larger because he's going to be more fierce and scare away more people, right? So you breed your dog to be larger, say a Great Dane, and now you take 20 years, and a Great Dane, you're lucky if he makes it to 8 or 9. Saint Bernard, the same thing, just large because of his size again, of more pounds. And then Hugh talked about the teacup poodles. I put a picture of them. They're really cute. 3 years if they survive birth and infancy. The death rate of the teacup poodles is very high, and they're very expensive because most of them don't even make it out of their first year of life.
Well, they get stepped on.
Thank you. There's a picture in the teacup. The problem, not only does their lifespan decrease, the other problem obviously is we found is when you push animals to make them larger or make them extremely smaller, It gives them, obviously, all these health problems. The shorter lifespan we talked about, arthritis in large dogs is very bad. People that have large dogs typically say if you have a large dog, you have a puppy for 3 years, you have a good dog for 3 years, and then you have a lame dog for 3 years. And obviously, it's just not there. Epilepsy, breathing problems, birthing at death. That was the teacup poodles and the large dogs. Temperature. Anyways, it goes on and on. And all of these, you don't find these in wolves. Wolves is a very healthy animal that can live in the wild. You don't have to pamper and take care of it. He can live a long life out there. But when you modify these animals, you get all these bad things happen. Hugh talked about this. The dogs have the greatest genetic diversity, so we can make these changes. For contrast, things like chimpanzees and marsupials have a very small DNA diversity. So no matter how much you bred your chimpanzee, he's going to still look exactly the same. Animals that have very small populations have small genetic diversity, and so you can't change them. So only dogs, because they have if the wolf lives all over the world, and there were lots of them, did we have this genetic diversity to be able to change them. Horse would be the second example. People say 6,000 years. I think it was probably more than that, but that's what the number that's out there. An average horse that you can ride, like the person has there, lifespan, 28 years. Maybe 20 years of rideability, last 8 years is going to be a senior citizen. They wanted bigger horses, and this started in the Middle Ages for the knights to ride on. Knight puts on 300 pounds of armor, your regular horse isn't going to survive, so a regular horse is going to only support maybe 200 pounds. So if you want to put an extra 300 pounds, they started breeding the horses to be bigger. And of course, when you did that, 10 years came off its lifespan. So the ponies were bred to work in mines. When you shrink an animal, the lifespan doesn't go down as much. But the health problems go. So with ponies, we made them smaller. They have big problems with hormone imbalance, poor hoofs, lameness, high levels of blood fat in their body. They're just a lot more higher maintenance cost. The draft horse, because he's larger, as we talked about, has a whole bunch of things. They have ones where just their skin and their hoofs just rot and fall off. It's bad. It's really bad news. The heavier weight makes them very difficult for them, for their muscles and their arthritis, overheating. So we can see that species do not like to change, is what my conclusion is. We've seen this with dogs, horses, the bacteria, mice. When we breed them, when we try to change them from what their wild normal is, when we breed them away, they never get improved. They always get sicker, less healthy, and less survivability. And nature wouldn't do much more the same. If we have a whale, we have horses, we have elephants that are huge, if there was some advantage for them being bigger, it would be there. So if these animals were able to change and be good and survivable, then I could say, yes, life likes to change. Evolution is maybe a possibility. But everything we've seen, they don't like to change. The second thing that drives change, and this is the magic bullet for those that believe in evolution, is to say, well, mutations are what made all these features like eyes and hearts and lungs, made animals bigger, gave them all these various traits that they may have. So there was some random mutation, that mutation was beneficial, and that beneficial mutation then carries down through natural selection. And so the two of them working together can account for everything in life. So let's take a look. Do mutations actually do that? So mutations are errors in the copying of the DNA, typically related to for changing in species, particularly in the reproductive process. So if there's a mutation, in the reproductive cells, that will get passed on. If I have just one gene that mutates in my skin, that's not going to get passed down on to my offspring. Hughes talked about this, that it's, that for eggs, the mutation is very minimal, and for the man, there's more mutations. So any change that happens in animals typically happens to the male lineage, not the women. So mutations go into three categories: neutral, and most of them in that category; harmful, means it's not going to be very good for that animal; and then beneficial, which is the one that the people who believe in evolution is counting on, is going to say that's going to create all these new features and all these great adaptations that these animals have. What we've seen, obviously, is larger animals, like the draft horse, large dogs, They're going to have more deleterious mutations, negative mutations, and what we see in the fossil record, that changes, drives them extinct. We have animal, in real time, we've been seeing this. Examples of neutral mutations, I gave out some of my favorites. Because we have so many people going through MRIs now, full body scans of your body, the doctors have been totally amazed to find out that a lot more people than they thought actually, or even you in some of this room, are walking around and maybe you only have one kidney or maybe you have three. And you wouldn't know it because your body functioned properly unless you had an MRI, a full body MRI, and they saw that. If you're healthy and you never need a full body MRI, you know, or chest x-ray things, you wouldn't see that. But they find out it's actually very common for people to have only one kidney or three. Different color eyes, happens in cat, white cats a lot. I had a cat just like this. Happens in people occasionally. Extra digits, I like this one. Some of them are kind of odd, obviously, where you have like a false one thing. And this little guy here obviously has a true hand that's completely functional, but has six digits. And that's a common mutation. Manx cats born without tails, that's a mutation also. And you could go on and on. There's quite a few neutral ones that just don't harm the species or benefit them. Negative mutations, oh my gosh, because we have thousands of doctors and millions of people going to thousands of doctors, they actually catalog it. And if you go onto Wikipedia, they list over 8,000 mutations that they've, negative mutations they found in humans.
Wait, 800
negative mutations. And of course the list is growing because with our technology of being able to DNA sequencing much quicker than it used to, that list is growing. So you know, this, I expect this list in a short time to be over 1,000. These are the most common ones here, diabetes being the most common one that you've probably heard of, hemophilia very common, Down syndrome. So there's some of these you've heard of, some of them you haven't heard of. Yeah, sickle cell. So it goes on and on. And then same way we talked about, obviously, that if you have a dog, you know, who has a mutation, who's larger, and you breed them to be larger, the same with humans. If you're lucky enough, you know, to be a basketball player, be over 7 feet, you may have an advantage swinging hoops, but I can tell you, unfortunately, it's going to decrease your lifespan. That people that have the mutation of being giants, it reduces their lifespan. Likewise, dwarfs also, you know, have it there. So once again, life likes to be about the height of, you know, 4 to 6 feet for humans. And when you get below six, and you go, well, not above six, seven. Let's say seven, obviously. Sorry, Jim, I didn't mean to offend you.
I'm 21 and a half.
when you get between 4 and 7 feet is where life likes to be. And if you're above seven, you're below four, you know, it has problems with your health also. So we see the same thing we've seen with the dogs and the horses. We see that in humans also. Not that I don't think humans are, you know, purposely breeding that way, but it just appears. Beneficial. This was interesting. I spent hours looking through the internet to find some real-time beneficial mutations that we could identify and say these are mutations that helped, obviously, you know, mankind. The most interesting one is a number of European Jews have a mutation in their white blood cell that makes them immune to the HIV virus, which is incredible. You know, kind of God's special protection for those people, obviously, and we've seen that in other places where God gave special protection to the Jews. Not every single Jew has it, but there's a good portion of them, you know, maybe 30% of them that are immune to the HIV virus. They get the virus, and the virus just cannot penetrate their white cell. There is one family in Connecticut that was born with extra thick and strong bones. You know, if they were born in the Middle Ages where there was hand-to-hand combat, that probably would be an advantageous experience, adaptation. But in today's culture, I don't think that's going to give them any advantage. So I don't think they're going to take over the world. There's a very rare human mutation where you can have twice the muscle size and be very low fat. It just happens randomly, not in a particular population or whatever. Very random. It's a recessive gene, so not every family member will get it. You know, their kids may be perfectly fine. A couple of generations will pop up again. And then he was talking about this is natural selection mutations of improved human eyesight. And that's kind of easy to see. If you can't see an arrow or club coming to you, you're probably not going to live long. Glasses have obviously eliminated that. And then taller people, stronger people, you know, with mutations, diet, obviously the human population's got taller. This is it. You know, so we have millions of people visiting thousands of doctors, and this is the best that they can come up with of how mutations are making these new wonderful advances, you know, in human life. I just don't see it, you know. So other than for bacteria, mutations pretty much drive things extinct. And the reason it works for bacteria is because of their huge population, you know. And Hugh says maybe for termites, maybe for ants, maybe that will help them too. This is the one I like, elephant trunk. Learned about elephants. It just, you could, their whole body is very interesting, but particularly if you focus on their trunk. Their trunk has got 60,000 individual muscles in the trunk that's strong enough to uproot a tree. You can see this elephant, African elephant here moving a huge tree. And yet, obviously, if I put the quarter on the ground and teach to pick it up, or a teeny peanut, he can get with his little nose pick that up also. If you read the explanations for the trunk, they will try and tell you that there were 60,000 random mutations to make those 60,000 new muscles in his nose. By contrast, you know, your nose has got, you know, three or four or five, not many at all. And so it's just incredible, obviously, that to think that's random mutations. And again, they believe it's random. There are a few people that say there's some hidden force in life that's creating all these things, but they just can't find it. And of course, the problem with that is now that we've sequenced DNA and you look at the DNA, there is nothing hidden there. So they have a problem. Then I thought about, well, if this elephant's trunk is 6 feet long, what did the elephants before him look like? They must have had shorter trunks. Well, they get even weirder. If you look at prehistoric mammals and you look at the pictures of them, it looks like God has a sense of humor. I put a couple of them here. I wish I would have done a slide of all of them, because all the prehistoric elephants and rhinoceroses and hippopotamuses, they look to us just so funny. I mean, when they still are trying to figure out what in the world this elephant does with this tusk. At first, they thought it was scooping vegetation off the bottom of the of swamps. They now think that it was designed for stripping bark off tree. But whatever it is, this is the actual skull down below, just so you know. I mean, my wife saw this, and she thought it was like a cartoon, a prank, right? So I put a picture of the actual skull below, and it's the shovel-nosed elephant, and he was predecessor to the modern African and Asian elephant. And you can see he does have a shorter trunk, so he maybe doesn't have 60, maybe only has 30,000 mutations in his trunk. But then, of course, his lower jaw comes out with these shovel teeth, you know. And we're going from this to this in just millions of years, by the way. You know, not billions of years or hundreds of millions of years. Just in millions of years, we're claiming we go from this elephant to this elephant. So when we look at the fossil record, what did we see? So when you have the A here, that is what Darwin and everybody expected. The more we dig up these fossils, we're going to find all these transitions, and we're going to see life gradually change out, and that will prove it. And so when I became a Christian, doubted people that everybody just give us more time, and we'll dig up some more bones, we'll fill in these missing links in there, and you will see that the fossil record will look like this nice tree with all these branches come out. When we give them 50, 60,000 years, and the paleontologists love to dig up all these bones, but what do they find? They find A and C. That species appear, remain totally unchanged, like that elephant with the shovel. He just appears. He's got a shovel. There's no one with a half a shovel. No one, half a shovel. You know, it's all the way out there, and then he disappears. And then all of a sudden, the African elephant shows up, and the woolly mammoth shows up. You know, the woolly mammoth looks kind of like an African elephant with bigger tusk and hair. You don't find any of these gradual, and that goes with everything. There are very few missing links. There's a few animals that you could say, okay, kind of looks like in between the two, but not this gradual. And then we're going to talk about the Cambrian explosion, which is obviously really problematic. Hugh has talked a lot about that, so I'm not going to spend time on that, where it literally is like this, where you have one or two species, and then all of a sudden you have everything.
Dave, you mentioned we found examples of A and C. I think you meant B.
Oh, B. Excuse me. Yes, S. Yes. A, there, yeah, they were looking for A, and everything we found is B and C. Correct. Thank you. I'll let you. Hugh's cited this verse, but without the reference, so I put it up there with the reference. But Hugh has cited this very often, talking about God's creative, and He wants to pack the earth with life. And we have another verse that talks about this. You know, and again, this is written by Jews, you know, a semi-arid version of the desert, you know, not necessarily slush and green, and yet they realized that God had packed this planet with life in every little corner. Hughes talked about some of these extinction events, but not in detail, and hasn't listed all of them. The first two are Cambrian explosions. Take that back, obviously. Mass speciation. So the first two mass speciations is the Cambrian explosion we know all about. We've done enough fossil digging now to realize that there is an explosion about 33,000 years before the Cambrian explosion, called the Avalon explosion. So before the Avalon explosion, everything is just basically singular animals, or maybe a couple animals with a few cells working together, you know, like fossils or sponges and things. And with the Avalon explosion, you have this whole variety of these soft-bodied animals. You know, if you've ever seen a sea slug, it basically kind of looks like that, but has lots of frills around it. But there's like, you know, 5, 10, 50 different types of them, and so there's lots of them. And so we know now that the Cambrian explosion is not the only explosion, that before that we have the Avalon explosion that happened a little bit before that. Cambrian explosion comes along, Hughes talked about this, just every body plan appears. After that, we have life, but we have these mass extinction events. Some of these were really clear about what caused them. Some of them are still in for a debate. Down below is the graph to show about how severe they were. So the late Jurassic and the late isn't severe, but some of these were really, really catastrophic, where just lots of life disappears, and then immediately you have all new life appear in a very short period with a complete ecosystem. Here's the picture, the Avalon explosion. And so we have all these frilly animals. No armor yet, but multicellular animals that are very complex, capable of moving, and occupy the whole seafloor. So they're not in just one area. If you go to this rock layer, you have these everywhere, just as you go to the Avalon, the Cambrian explosion, you have the life forms everywhere in that shale. Cambrian explosion, you have every body plan appears. So this is where the bottom problem is with the phyla, is a major body plan. So we're vertebrae that have a backbone. You have mollusks that have shells. What else we've got up here? Coral, sponges, kelp, seaweed, all these worms, you know. So we have all these different body plans, and they appear just so rapidly there's no time for evolution to appear. And from we know about natural selection and mutation, it just can't account for this amount of diversity this quickly at this time period. Oh, crustaceans was the other one I was missing. All the body plans appear.
Hey, Dave?
Yeah.
Do we have any more of these for the front table? No.
Okay. No. I don't know. You asked the wrong person. Colleen may have a couple. Okay. Ask Colleen.
Okay.
Yes.
Where would jellyfish be?
In the Cambridge. Jellyfish, I think, were there. I have a picture of them, but they show up fairly early also. they're in their own group. They look like a mollusk with a soft body part, but they don't have a beak, so they're not a mollusk. They're in their own category. And we'll talk a little bit about them. This is the one Hughes talked about. This is the one that was the most striking, because we have a mass extinction event where 95% of all life goes extinct. Everything that's alive disappears. And literally, obviously, even people that believe in evolution have said that the rock layer is so thin that within just 10,000 years, you have complete ecosystems with new bodies, plants. And it's more faith than I could have, because I just don't see the evidence. And so you have these big, and not little things, you got these big, huge dinosaurs that are all different than the dinosaurs that were killed. Very, very difficult to explain. Hugh has talked about this one. So we have a mass extinction event. All the dinosaurs go extinct. And then you have, all of a sudden, all these Cretaceous dinosaurs that just are large bodies and look different. And then we talked about the large bodies do not like to change. So it really looks like God replaced them all. Living fossils, we're talking about 95% of life went extinct. Well, 5% survive. Well, what do we call those 5% that survive? We call them living fossils. And the wonderful thing about living fossils is when we see them on all the rock layers, all the way going back. And, of course, do they ever change? No, life doesn't like to change. Horseshoe crab appears shortly after the Cambrian explosion. Been on the East Coast, you know, for 450 million years. Elephant sharks, you know, we got something even more complex. We've got something, you know, with lungs and gills and fins and cartilage body, no bones. But again, he shows up, you know, just shortly after this horseshoe crab, and he's still swimming in the oceans and never changed. Giant Chinese salamander. And I could go on and on. I actually had more pages. My wife made me cut it down a little bit so we can get to the topic, which is a good thing. But if you're ever interested, just type in living fossils, and it just goes on and on and on. One of the ones I deleted was one of the very first fish, which goes back to just shortly after the Cambrian. They thought it was totally extinct because they'd only seen it there. And then a fisherman, you know, off, I remember it was either Africa or South America, drugged up one of these fish and never saw it, took it into town, and somebody's like, that's right here in the encyclopedia, went extinct, you know, millions of years ago. And there it is, you know. So they continue finding these living fossils. Quoted this verse just, I think, last week, and didn't give the reference, so I put the reference up here. But it is, the Bible declares that it is. It, you know, this, the fossil record matches what the Bible says. It's the lot in life for animals to go extinct, and they die. And who recreates, you know, these new species that we see that appear in this fossil record out of nowhere? Obviously, it's God's Spirit. And so God sends His Holy Spirit to earth and renews the face of the earth and fills it with life as quickly as He can. Here's another prehistoric mammal over here. I didn't look up. I have had two prehistoric mammals I put in there, obviously just funny animals, but you know, they have a difficult time. If you read it, obviously, just two scientists will put these things in different trees because obviously it's so difficult because they just look so different than everything else. Yeah, prehistoric mammals. And another one, obviously, just teeming with life. And we're fighting that, as Hugh said, whether we go up in the atmosphere 100,000, you know, 100,000 feet or the depths of a mine, you find life everywhere. God has packed the earth with life. Okay, so now I'm done with this. You can ask questions and you can make comments because we're going to head into the topic of convergent evolution, or I say, or is it intelligent design? So the description obviously is that you will see an animal that are totally unrelated. You know, I mean, it might as well be a tree, you know, versus, you know, a squirrel. Is that different? That they have no common ancestor, or the common ancestor is so far back that it gets into these sponges or very small, you know, animals with no resemblance. And yet, in these totally unrelated species, you will find them be in the same environment ecosystem. But more than that, they're going to look exactly the same, and they're going to have exactly the same adaptations. And so they just say that obviously you roll the dice, and of course these animals are going to come up with these same features because they're in the same niches and they need this. You know, mutations, natural selections, I don't think is going to do that, and the resemblance is just incredible. And it looks more obviously like God doing common designs. Yes?
In a couple of sentences, and I've studied this and I can't remember it, that I can remember when you speak to somebody who believes in evolution and they bring up the Darwinian thing about the finches and how they saw the big figure. In a couple of sentences, how can you say that quickly that wasn't, you know, how it was?
I have a wonderful thing. I have a slide we're going to get to here. Is if they want to talk about beaks, then you can ask them, well, what about these other beaks? How did these animals get these beaks? And you can change the conversation. I mean, growing a beak bigger and smaller isn't a big adaptation. You know, we can change. I mean, you sit there and say the beak is nothing. You say, look what we've done with dogs. You know, dogs have even more variety. I mean, you know, we're not talking about their nose getting a little bit longer and smaller. We're talking about teacup poodles versus Great Danes. You know, you can do a lot to dogs. But then you say, no matter how small you make that teacup poodle, he's not going to turn to a mouse. And no matter how big you get that Great Dane, he's never going to turn into a horse. You know, life doesn't like to change. And so these finches don't like to change either. Their beaks will get a little bit bigger and smaller, but that's all you can do with them. You can't do more. So you have to make them bigger. So you have to say these micro evolution versus macro evolution. You say, I believe that you can make small little changes, but you cannot change that finch to be a hawk.
Right.
You know, you can't change the species. You know, that once an animal's in its kind, it only reproduces to its kind, and it can't reproduce to another kind. How do you get there? And that's where you talk about mutations and natural selection just can't get an animal to some place it wants to go.
How did did that adapt to? I can't remember this, and I've learned it a million times.
Yeah, yeah.
Did those beaks on those finches turn?
Yeah, you can see there's a cycle if all there is large nuts to eat, then the birds with larger beak as well get a little bit bigger, you know. And then I can't remember the advantage of the smaller beak, obviously now at the moment.
Little
cracks and get smaller things, right? So there is an advantage for both of those.
They did get get bigger maybe by hitting it more, like exercise?
No, no. We talked about this. This is by passing on your genes to your kids. If your beak's a little bit bigger, you're going to survive and you're going to have children. But if your beak is teeny and you can't get crack open that big nut, all your kids are going to die. But that's why I used the example of killing all the redheads. I thought they're bold enough you would remember that. I thought it was not a good thing to say, but I figured I'd drive the point home about killing all the redheads, and pretty soon you're not going to be redheads, you know?
I could say there probably were bigger beaks.
Yes.
And those, they had their, they just created and
right.
Had theirs. There were little ones. And
yeah, but the key is obviously is to go from that beak and say, agree, and say the beak can get bigger and smaller, and say, and then go to the dogs and say, obviously, look at these dogs. We can make dogs bigger and smaller, you know, but when you drive them away, obviously, you know, to any extreme. So you can change the beak size, and the finch is not going to half its life size.
Right.
But if you tried to make that finch twice the size it is, I could guarantee you the finch is going to half its life size.
I got it.
Right. Yeah.
Also, that was when it was a drought time. The bigger seeds survived.
Right. There you go.
But further studies show that when the rainy seasons came back, and the Galapagos Islands, the smaller seeds came back and the finch's beak size went back down.
Just like the bacteria we talked about. If you remove what happens, that recessive gene is still there, and they want to go back to where they were.
Right.
They don't want to change. John.
Well, you can also explain it as a survival advantage within the narrow genetic diversity of the species and its boundaries.
Yeah.
And you can also say with confidence, based on your survey of evolution, that some of the science is clear that there must be some hidden, unseen, creative entity that produces these species.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. So just like life came from outer space and spaceships, evolution is driving them to make absurd observations. Okay, I want to get to this. Marsupials is the biggest place to look at this convergent evolution because the contrast is just so stark. So we're going to talk about just what a marsupial is, because most people think of just kangaroos because that's what we see pictures of, or maybe a koala, but it's a much bigger variety of species. A marsupial carries their young in a pouch, and their young are born hairless and very small. The next slide will have a picture of that. Placenta, that's what us are as mammals are. We carry a young, the mom carries the young within her body, and the baby is born pretty much fully functional, looks a lot like it's going to do when it gets older, maybe a little bit more hair. And then we also have three or four species of egg-laying mammals. And these are found in Australia. The platypus has become very famous, but the platypuses are born lay eggs. So there's actually leg-laying mammals. The split, looking at the fossil record, they claim the split between these three types of mammals because they're radically different. Obviously, they can't interbreed. They're totally radically different. Happened maybe 120 to 160 million years ago. We found in China the fossil of the first marsupial, and this is a recreation from his bone. It's basically a mouse-sized possum. And so from all marsupials that I'm going to show you, this is what it came from. And marsupial,
in quotes, yes.
This is what they say, that all these marsupials, the macroevolution, people believe that all marsupials are descendants of this little guy here in China, a little mouse-sized possum in China. And it's easy to tell because their bones are quite different. So it's when we look at this, we know it's a marsupial, or we know it's a placenta, or egg-laying mammal, because their body bones are very different, because if you're going to have a pouch and support this animal, you've got to be able to have the bones to do that. So marsupials used to be, as you can see, in South America. They used to be in Asia. They used to be everywhere. They've gone extinct on all the other continents, and so they only are found on Australia right now. And it's been that way for a long time because the continents obviously have split a long time ago. The exception, obviously, is here in America, all over America, from Virginia to California. We have the Virginia possum. And much debate about where he came from, because obviously he's kind of like on the wrong continent. And a lot of people think they're rats. I've had people call me up. I'm a Boy Scout. People call me up. I got a big rat in my backyard. It's huge, Dave. And I'm like, no. I said, you know, he's a marsupial. You know, if you've got a garden, he's good. They like to eat slugs and they like to eat snails, but they prefer cat food and dog food. This is the young. So every marsupial starts like this little teeny hairless animal. So they're born, and it's just an amazing process. It's amazing these things even reproduce at all. So this little thing is born and has just two little limbs in the front, and he has to climb from the mom's down below where he's born, and has to climb up and get in the pouch and attach himself to an initial nipple, or he will die. And so typically they have lots of these things, you know, like a possum will typically have maybe 10, and maybe 6 of them will make it into the pouch. So they do reproduce lots of them, so that's how they don't go extinct. And so then it has to stay in that pouch until it becomes, you know, a fully grown little adolescent, like the one that you see in the kangaroo patch. So every marsupial, that's what defines them, is their babies. The only one, the other animal that their young looks like is a rabbit. Rabbits, their babies are born hairless and very small like this also, but they stay underground and the mom works really hard to keep them warm. But every other mammal is outside of the marsupials is born, you know, fully with hair and warm and things. So somebody's going to look at marsupials. So this one here, marsupial versus placenta, meaning obviously a normal mammal that's going to give birth. All of you have obviously seen gray wolves. We just talked about them a lot. That's where dogs came from, was gray wolves, maybe a little DNA from a fox. This poor animal went extinct in about 1962. He had a nasty habit of eating sheep, and they have a lot of sheep in Australia, and the hunters shot them all dead, and so it went extinct. But the Tasmanian wolf looked exactly like a gray wolf. And so much, obviously, this comparison here, as you can see the skull and the jaw photographed from every angle. And if you're not an expert, you know, in animal bones, if I handed you the skull of this Tasmanian wolf, whose closest relative is a kangaroo, and a gray wolf, who, of course, is in the canine ability, you and I would not be able to tell these animals apart. And yet, obviously, we're supposed to believe that these two animals evolved totally different just from the environment of hunting squirrels and wolves and whatever, or sheep, evolved exactly the same. So this is a classic example of what they call convergent evolution, that we have two animals that are totally unrelated, one a canine, the other one a kangaroo, basically, and yet this wolf had a pouch, and its baby was born and crawled in that pouch, and that wolf carried its baby around. So. This one's extinct, both of these, so everybody's familiar with the saber-toothed cat. You know, we see them in Ice Age movies and lots of movies. But down in Australia, they had exactly the same animal at the same time, giant canine teeth, and there's a picture of it, and it's pretty accurate because we know now once you put muscle on bone, there's ways to do that, so these photos are pretty accurate nowadays. We didn't know in the past, we have the technology to recreate from the bones is your thing. So we have this saber-toothed cat that had a pouch, carried its baby in a pouch, and yet it looked very much like the other one. And we go on and on and on. This one's still living, flying squirrel. We have those here in North America. Can jump off a tree, put its legs out, skin so it can float to another tree to find some nuts over there. In Australia, they have both the sugar glider and the squirrel glider. And both these animals, again, have pouch. And their closest relative is a possum with exactly the same adaptation and very similar faces and things. It even gets more striking. We go along. This one's really incredible because if you, obviously, again, we're not an expert, and if you were in Australia and you saw this little hopping mouse go by, you know, you would think he's exactly the same as the kangaroo rat that lives in the desert here in the Mojave Desert. Same body shape, same hind legs, same long thin tail, same hop, nocturnal, burrowing, seeding animal. Almost indistinguishable, you know, between the two. I guess the hopping mouse's ears are maybe a little bit bigger, but very very same pouch. Yeah, except for the pouch. Yeah, pouch is so small you can't see it. But the
environment.
No, these are both desert animals. Okay. That's why I said they're both designed for hot. I put that down there just so people know that they're living in the same hot desert environment. Yeah. This one here is the one that really, this one really got me to the point where, like, you got to be kidding you. You're going to tell me that this is coincidental? So we have now a mole. His closest relative, again, is a possum. And he looks exactly like the golden mole that you find in Africa. Same color, same strong claws. Ears are little teeny holes. The eyes are completely gone. The skin has grown over the eyes. Fur has grown over the eyes. No eyes. Huge claws. Eats the same food, looking for grubs, worms, and things like that. No eyes. You know, digs under the ground. Leather nose, obviously, for you know, being tough, very tough skin, very tough nose, to be able to get in the dirt without its nose being scuffed up or things. And yet, this was amazing because which way do you think the pouch faces? Most all animals, all things, their pouch is pointing this way. What would happen to this mole if his pouch was like the possum that it came from? It would fill with dirt. His pouch is upside down. So he can crawl forward and dirt not get into his pouch. Yeah. Incredible. Just totally incredible. You know? And yet, once again, you know, if you look at the tree, we had that little tree there. He goes back. This is a possum. This is evolved, quote-unquote, evolved from a possum. Just incredible. Actually, supposed to have three pictures on this one. Most of you have seen wallabies, obviously. Big hind legs, big ears, kind of a snout that sticks out, vegetarian. The mar over here lives only in Argentina, and he's a rodent. And so he's totally unrelated to the wallaby. And the third picture that was supposed to be there was supposed to be the hare, which is a lagomorph. So rabbits, hares, and pinkas are lagomorphs. Originally they thought that they were rodents, but doing DNA testing and looking at their teeth, they realized that hares, rabbits, and pinkas are totally unrelated to rabbits. They're not anywhere on the genetic tree. You know, they're totally different. I didn't put that in here, but that's the third one. So we have three animals that have this big hind legs, big ears, you know, similar looking face, you know, similar environment, same diet, all different places in the tree, you know, all looking very similar. Wings. Wings appear everywhere. So we have them in a reptile, we have them in a mammal, the bat, we have them in birds, which most people think of, in insects. The flying fish, granted, does not flap his fins and fly, but he can glide really far, I mean, like 50 yards. If he's scared and he's being chased, he'll swim and get a lot of lift up there. And if there's any thermals, he can take advantage of that, and he can soar out of the water quite a bit. So once again, wings appear in all these different species, totally unrelated, obviously. I don't have to explain that. This one's really amazing. Nature does not like people, is what I call this one. You mess with me, and I'm going to hurt you, is what this is called. So these species developed a special gland for making poison, and then on top of that, had to couple that with a tube that goes to a hypodermic needle. Humans did not invite hypodermic needles until the Civil War, because we had so many people that needed care and needed, you know, blood transfusions. So hypodermic needles were, for even humans, was not invented until maybe about 100 years ago, where all of these animals, and a lot of them very ancient, we talked about the jellyfish, obviously, very ancient animals, the mollusk here, very ancient animals. Scorpions have been around a long time, going back almost to the Cambrian explosion. And so poison glands and hypodermic needles developed very early in all these different species to protect themselves. And so this one is really a common design. It can't be evolution and original outcomes. Yes?
Animals like that just go after humans, or do they basically...
No, it's to protect them for everything. I mean, the stingray in the middle, we all know what happened to the crocodile hunter, you know. He got too close to this guy here, you know, a big 60-foot one. They're on their tail, they have one single barb, and they can take that tail and whip it up and got him right in the chest and put the poison right into his heart. He died almost instantaneously. So the stingray, he uses that to defend himself. A shark comes along, he gives that shark, you know, a big jab, obviously, and that shark's going to leave him alone, and then eventually he grows it back. If you go to the aquariums, they snip those off so you can pet them, just to let you know. You can snip it off and it grows back. So it's amazing, obviously, for the rays. A lot of this is defending. And the thing like the snake is not for defending, obviously. A lot of people that get bit by snakes actually get dry bites. The snake is smart enough, and he needs that venom to get food. And if his stomach is empty and he has to bite you, he'll probably do a dry bite because he needs to save his venom, because it'll take him a month to make his venom, because if he doesn't have the venom, he's not going to get his squirrel, he's not going to get his rat. And so the dry bites is when, if his stomach's full and he's feeling well, you know, he'll give it all to you. But typically these venom ones, they're using that to catch their prey. And the fish, of course, is just so they won't get eaten. The spiders, of course, is so that they can get insect and eat. So most of these things are for that. Bee would be the one that's totally protection. It doesn't matter what animal. If you go after their honey, they're going to defend themselves. So that's obviously a totally defensive mechanism. So some of them is actually to hunt their food, you know, in the case of the spiders and the jellyfish. But some of these are purely defensive, obviously. The bee would be the most one that's defensive. And, of course, the platypus. Maybe we got a platypus again. He shows up a lot of time. He's such an oddity. obviously, that only the male platypus has got a spur on his leg that he can use to defend himself. So yeah, on the stinging nettle, So obviously there we have a plant. My sons have experienced this. I told them, stay out of the stream, and they went down the stream anyways, and they came back, and it gives you a painful injection that hurts for about, hurts really bad for about a half hour. I mean, he's almost in tears. But it's the underside of it is just covered with tons of little needles, and it's, they're not very long, and so obviously, you know, it's designed if an animal, you know, tries to bite it, they're only going to eat that plant once. This one's really incredible. This is one I didn't know about until I did research for this. They have actually have done this where they take koala fingerprints and turn them into police departments, and they would put them in their database. I didn't put it on here. There's lots of pictures on the internet with koala bears with the sign underneath them, their prism number, because the experts could not tell that it was a koala and not a human being. Chimpanzees have them, obviously, also, but they're different, you know. But the koala print and the human print are so identical that even FBI experts have been fooled by giving koala fingerprints, that they think it's a small child committed some crime. Beaks obviously have come in lots of different animals. So we have them in reptiles. We have them in birds, obviously. A duck and an eagle is what I gave you. The platypus, of course, until they brought a live one to America and to the UK, people still thought that somebody had taken some duck and sewed this onto a beaver, because it obviously is the only mammal that has a beak. The other two that you see down here is the one squid is under. Squid is a squid beak, and the other one is an octopus beak. There have been divers that have been injured by the Humboldt squid. Humboldt squid's about my size, you know, up by Oregon. And if a diver gets too close and he takes a bite, he can just take a big nick out of your skin because his beaks are so sharp. Yes?
How many different species of squid have you come across, or have they come across?
No, every squid and every octopus has this. Every squid and octopus have the beak for the squid is designed for nipping off meat. They'll just go up to people, you know, things, so obviously, and just take a little bite out of it. And if the bite's small enough, the animal will survive. It's a big problem. They also do this with submarines. Submarines have sonar, and they have a big plastic ring about this big for sonar. And the squids see that rubber. For some reason, they smell maybe the oil of the rubber, and they keep taking bites out of the rubber, so they have to replace the submarine all the time. These squids are eating the rubber off submarines. The octopus beak is designed for crushing. He lives on the bottom, so he's looking for, you know, crabs and lobster and things like that, and his beak is so sharp that he just crushes through there and can break, obviously, the bones of shrimp and lobster and things like that, and he uses that for getting his food. So beaks everywhere. Wonderful design. So I asked that. Well, this is obviously Tasmanian devil. He is a small animal with a really bad temper, and you can imagine he looks exactly like the wolverine, which is a small animal with a very bad disposition also. Two animals you do not want to mess with, and yet obviously, again, the Tasmanian devil has a pouch. So I asked the question, you know, was this convergent evolution invented in order to explain a difficult theory? You know, when there really is no experimental evidence to show that these animals can adapt these things in these different environments. You know, again, what we know about mutations and what we know about natural selection, I don't see how it could produce this stuff. It has to be common design. You know, Hugh hasn't done this a long time ago. He would say, well, why do most cars have four wheels? Right? It's because it's the most optimum design. You know, we've made cars with three wheels and they're not as stable. We made cars with two wheels, they're very unstable. You can make a car with six wheels, but then you have less fuel efficiency. You can have more weight, but you have more less fuel efficiency. You can make it with 18 wheels. Those are pretty good too, you know, if you're moving something really big, but it's not economical again. So most cars have four wheels. So why do most of the body plans have four, you know, limbs? You know, and why do we have all these common designs? And what I could get into and I didn't get into is the hearts and lungs and brain and things like that developing again in larynx. The octopus, we should have time to get to more octopus slide. The octopus is a very intelligent animal, and yet his closest relative is a clam or a mussel. So we have brains developing in totally different species. Yes?
Yeah, you just got down to ask a question. Uh-huh. Convergent evolution also applies at the more smaller level. For example, I think octopus-like eyes.
I'm going to get to the next one we're going to do. Yep. The eyes here. We're going to do eyes. Pill bugs. So we have a pill bug and the millipede. look identical. If you're looking from 6 feet away, you're not going to tell the difference. One of them is a crustacean, which is a totally different phyla than the millipedes. Millipedes are their own one. This is what you're referring to, and I think we've talked about this a little bit, that if you were to look at the eye of an octopus, the eye of a human, they're going to be very similar. It's pretty funny. I was talking about this with somebody, and they're like, well, you know, they're very similar, but we have a blind spot, and the octopus doesn't. And I told him, that would be like you finding the Statue of Liberty, built in Australia 1,000 years ago, and telling me that her eyes are blue and ours are green. It's like you don't get the starking difference. Obviously, what was the Statue of Liberty doing in Australia 1,000 years ago? Isn't that miraculous? And you want to tell me what color the eyes are different? And so that proves that this was a standard outcome of civilizations, because the eyes are different. I mean, the blind spot is different there. We do have a blind spot, and our brain is big enough that it can overcome that blind spot, whereas the octopus brain is smaller, so he can't tolerate the blind spot. But the lens is identical, the focus is identical, the retina is identical, the optic nerve is different, the muscles to move it is all identical, and yet, we are obviously in the vertebrae line, and his closest relative, again, is a clam or a mussel. Yes?
Dave, if I were an evolutionist, I would say, yes, there are optimal designs, and evolution has a way of finding those optimal designs.
And I'd say where's your evidence for nature coming up with these designs? The fact that vertebrates have these complex eyes in itself is miraculous. The fact that it shows up in two different species even make it more miraculous. The fish, I should have put it obviously, this lung fish obviously that was there, that came up right after the Cambrian explosion. I mean, he has a big brain and fully functional eyes. And his closest relatives are sponges. I mean, how can you go from sponges and seaweed, and a sea cucumber to have a fish that has a fully functional brain, lungs, and eyes and things? And so the fact that we have this just in vertebrate is amazing. The fact that it shows up also now in something that's basically a mussel or a clam, where is that? It's not in the DNA. We've sequenced the DNA, and there's no hidden eye gene that you'll find in bacteria or sponges or mussels, right? We can sequence the DNA of mussels, and there's no hidden eye gene there that's going to appear later on. That makes sense? And so the complexity of it, you know a lot about complexity, the information, the complexity to make these objects is so advanced that to show up, have it come two times has got to be miraculous. Yes?
The genetic code is the key behind this, because often behind these similar or homologous organs and parts, you look at the genetic code behind them in these different species, and the genetic code is radically different in each one.
Yeah, radically
and
different.
If it were evolutionary related, the genetic code would be similar.
Yeah. Yeah. People have underestimated the octopus. The best one we have was the aquarium, set up a big tank with octopuses, and maybe 3-4 feet away, they put up a big tank with exotic shrimp around the world. And you can imagine, they opened the exhibit, everybody looked at the animals, they came in the next day, and the shrimp were all gone. The octopus had climbed out a hole that big on his tank, because if he can get his eye through something, he can get his whole body through it. So these are octopuses about this size. He went through that, took out of the water, which they'd never known, crawled across the floor, crawled up into the other tank, and the other tank had the same hole, right? Got in there, and the octopuses ate all the shrimp.
Wow.
And they totally underestimated how good his eye was, and they totally estimated his brain capacity. And so if you and that's the biggest danger, obviously, for people, why people die. If you underestimate, the animal, you don't understand the animal, you don't make the proper head of that, you lose your exotic shrimp, And the octopuses weren't feeling really good either because they'd ate too much. Anyway, echolocation, another amazing one. Here in three totally different species. So we have the bat everybody knows about, toothed whales, everybody knows about. But I was amazed to find out that we also have a bird in Latin America that also makes clicks and lives in caves exactly like a bat. And comes out and goes out and feeds at night, nocturnal. And so we have a bat bird, if you will. This is Latin America, Caribbean area. dolphins and whales. I could do a whole session about dolphins and whales. When you look at what the claims are, where these animals came from, it is just totally absurd. The evidence that they're showing of these animals are coming is just totally absurd. We don't have time to do that. Hovering, Hugh talked about this recently. I added in, and it's even more amazing. So I knew the hummingbird could hover and fly backwards. I knew the dragonfly could do it because I've seen them. And amazingly, there is a moth that has exactly the same adaptation and is capable of double jointing his wing and hovering and getting nectar exactly like a hummingbird. And it's the hummingbird hawk moth. Amazing. So we have hovering and flying backwards three times. This is one, I should have started with this one. This is the one Reasons Believe uses the most because it's most amazing. We have, again, a fish and a chameleon. You can't get anything too much more different. They have ball socket eyes, and they're independent, so they can look at different objects, and they focus not with their lens like we do. They focus with their cornea, very, very similar. Prickly hair. So we have, again, our leg-A mammal in Australia that has hair like a porcupine or hedgehog. And we have the real porcupine. This is the American porcupine, and I didn't realize that there's actually an old world. They have a porcupine in Europe, and he's different. His spines on his back are much longer, and they're not sure whether they're related or not. So these spiny hairs, totally independent. These animals, once again, totally unrelated animals appearing with spiked hair. Anteaters. We all think of anteaters. Strong claws, long sticky tongue for ants and termites. We have our leg-laying Australian mammal. Anteaters, armadillos, aardvarks. They are real. They're not fictionary. And in South America, Pangola. All with these strong four claws and, again, the long sticky tongue. And, again, none of these are related to one another. This has to have come up independently. This is amazing. There are three species of river dolphins, and they actually were so interesting, they actually did DNA sequencing of the entire DNA genome of these three dolphins because they wanted to see if they were related. These dolphins can only live in fresh water. They go into the ocean, they die. They have no way to get salt out of their body. They don't have that feature that the other dolphins have. And so they thought, well, maybe obviously the oceans were fresher, or maybe the continents were all together, and when the continents spread apart, they got isolated or whatever. But now they've done the DNA sequencing and found out that obviously these three dolphins are completely unrelated, and yet we have three freshwater dolphins in these three different rivers. And so they're claiming that some saltwater dolphin came up there, lost his glands to get rid of the salt, and turned a freshwater dolphin. I can't see that. Three times. Not once, but three times. Any questions? Or comments? Or feedback? Or anything? Yes? Millipede, yes.
Millipede, and also the other one, the
toba. Yeah, centipede and toba. It's this one here, yeah.
You call that a crustacean?
Crustacean. So the pill bug is a crustacean, which means his closest relative would be a crab, a lobster. That's those are typical crustaceans we think of. Whereas the other one is in a true millipede. Millipede meaning they have lots of legs. So I actually had a picture of a millipede up there also. It was long, skinny, without armor. So most millipedes don't have armor. So this millipede developed armor that's exactly like a crustacean. And these are on totally different evolutionary tracks. They both roll. Both of these are roly-polies. People see these and they call them roly-polies because it doesn't matter whether it's a pill bug or whether it's a millipede. And you can tell, obviously, unless you pick him up and turn him over and look at his legs and look at his head, you can't tell.
Well, here's the point. They proliferate in Carmel.
Right.
And one time, I actually saw one right outside my door. They were giving birth to live. They don't live.
Yeah. I don't remember. There are a number. There's a number of insects that give live birth, and it's the same thing. There's actually some reptiles that give live birth. I actually had a pet snake, and was totally shocked, obviously, when all these little snakes came out of it, not eggs. I just freaked out. It was like, oh my gosh, what have I got myself into? Dad, I wanted a snake. I'm not sure I want it now, because now I've got, I can't just throw away the eggs. I've got all these little things. What do I feed them? disaster. So there are some reptiles and some insects that give live birth, and I don't know enough about these two to know which one they do. I would imagine that was probably the crustacean, because I think that the wood lice I think lay eggs, and just off my head I think the crustacean probably gives live birth. Yeah. 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 Well, if you have to look at the shell very carefully, you can see the shell is slightly different. Obviously, the pill bug has got more of these big jagged spots on it, where these ones the jagged spots are a little bit smaller. That's the only way I can tell them apart.
Which of them do you live like in a dry climate?
Now they live everywhere. I have both of these in my front yard. They're just everywhere. They're not in one particular location. Yeah, they're small, right? Like a small pea. So yeah, they're very, very interesting. But the amazing one, I don't have a picture of it. Obviously, a picture is they actually dredge it up from the bottom of the ocean. One of these that's about this big. It looks scary because it's got big eyes. Big things. I should have brought a picture of it. But they found these very, I remember, it has to be the crustacean because it's in the ocean. They found these crustaceans, that one of these, one, the ocean version, will actually get very big. And they roll up in little balls also, yeah. Yeah, because in the deep ocean, if you have a fish that one comes up and chew on you, you've got to roll up pretty small. I mean, that would be another one, obviously. We could do millipedes and go back and compare them to armadillos. They're both of them capable of rolling up into a small ball with lots of armor. So the ones that I gave here, so if you go on there, there's about 200 examples, and it really needs to be expanded. So I got into this on Wikipedia. There was maybe three examples, and I saw Hugh talked about one more. And I'm like, well, it has to be more than this. And I started just doing research on my own. And now I have the web page up to probably almost 180 examples, and I have to go back and put more, because while we have the pill bug curling up and protecting its armor with the armadillo. So they're not related either, and they both develop armor on their back, curve with these joints. This is how the knights made their armor. If you had a crack here on your armor, they would put the sword there, and so the same type of interlocking armor is what they came up with knights on their shoulders and their knees to protect them. And of course, these things had it millions of years before we ever figured that out. Yes.
Mutations, they replicate in bacteria. Do they?
Yes, bacteria, very good.
In animals, do they ever replicate, wondered?
Well, the greatest change we see is the mutation in the male DNA, that the male DNA can change. So the DNA that I have when I was a baby could change over time. And Hugh did a whole lesson on that, that alcohol, smoking, and even your behavior will change the male DNA that's produced, because it's being constantly produced in the male body. Whereas the woman is totally amazing, is when a woman's born, she has all of her eggs that she'll have her whole life. I mean, my wife and I did the math recently saying there has to be at least maybe 400 or 500 eggs in a woman, and she's born with those eggs, she carries them her whole life. She stops releasing them, but she has her whole life. Whereas males are constantly making their reproductive thing. And so if a person starts drinking alcohol, starts taking drugs, changing their behavior, the DNA that the body produces changes. So most of these mutations that we see is passed on through the male lineage. And that's where Hugh talked about the Bible verse talking about your sins being passed to the generation to generations. We have biological evidence that proves that if you have a male that's behaving in bad behavior, doing drugs, alcohol, or other detrimental behavior, it actually makes that your DNA that you pass on to your children bad. And of course, in any way, it's going to stay there. And it's going to get passed on. But for the female is the nurturer one, the one that produces life. That doesn't happen. She's born with all those eggs. Those eggs she has her whole life.
No,
they can mess those up too. You can mess it. Well, if a mom's drinking alcohol, she's going to affect her DNA also. Alcohol is a poison. I mean, if you drink too much, when somebody gets intoxicated, they literally are killing some of their brain cells. One of the reasons we talk about why is your brain only uses 10% of the cells or 10% of your brain, and that's because if you drink alcohol, if you're in a car accident, we know now that other parts of your brain can actually take over some other functions and help you. And that's one of the reasons the brains are over-designed, especially in large mammals. is that it can compensate for those problems, like drinking alcohol, doing drugs.
And do you think that a lot of the autism, I think it is, from a lot of people that are doing drugs and stuff,
yeah.
It seems like this generation.
Yeah.
I bet you that's a lot of that autism.
Yeah, that's probably a lot of it, yeah. Right, because we didn't have it as much in the past, and in the 60s generation that was doing all that stuff had their children, and it passed on to other children. Yeah. Yes?
And I would say recreational drugs for that, such as pharmaceutical drugs.
Yeah, well, there's an abuse of prescription drugs, too. We know lots of people that have abused prescription drugs also, and that would be a problem also. Yeah, yeah. The most drugs are poisons. I mean, if you have blood clots, they give you blood thinner, and the blood thinner that we're still giving people today, my uncle was on blood thinner for 10, 20 years, was nothing more than pharmaceutical rat poison. It's just a blood thinner. To kill rats, they give them a thing that makes them internal bleed, and you just give them the right amount, and it thins your blood. You know, my uncle was always sit there and say, why do I pay all this money for the drugs? It's nothing but rat poison, you know, and I couldn't argue with him, you know. I said, but it has to be the right amount, Reza. You don't want too much, so don't go to the store and buy your own rat poison and take it, because it's not going to be good for you, you know. It has to be the right amount. That's why you're paying all this money for this rat poison. Werfen, I believe it was called, yeah. Yes?
What would a cockroach be? Would that be crustacean or a...
Insect. The definition of an insect is has six legs. Insects all have six legs and start out as a larvae, and that's the definition of an insect. Yeah, so it has that. So the crustaceans, you know, they that's why we're talking about the live birth. They don't go through this larvae stage. They're born and they look the same their whole life. Insects are constantly going. Now, we always talk about the butterfly mutation because that's the most spectacular, but every insect goes through that mutation. I mean, the amazing one I found out of the picture of the fly I had is flies only live 1 week. They spend all their life, you know, 51 weeks as a larvae or as an egg, and they only spend 1 week as a fly looking for something for food before they lay their egg and start a whole larvae. So a lot of insects spend a lot of their life, and a mayfly is even worse. They only live 1 day, and the rest of their life they're either an egg or a larva. So you think your life is bad, you know? Yeah.
I got a question.
The maggot is the larvae, yes. So it goes maggot, yeah, egg, maggot. It goes into a pupa stage where it's a hard chrysalis, and then it turns into the fly. The fly then, you know, breathes, lays eggs, and it all starts over again. And that's the life cycle of insects. Six legs and go through that mutations thing. Yes, Steve, you had your hand up. Yes.
Yeah, what's a moth? There's a moth called a miller. What's that?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with miller moth. Moths are insects. They have six legs and they go through that metamorphic cycle.
But there's a name called a miller.
Yeah, I'd have to look that up. I don't have time. But I have my smartphone after the class, which is going to be really soon because we're near the end. I can look that up on my new smartphone. I have a new smartphone that's really fast, and I can look that up and find that for you. The amazing thing with some moths, because they only live a month, is there's some moths that are born with no mouth parts, which was really interesting. Caterpillars are also same thing. Caterpillars are insects, and that's why they have to eat so much, because they have to store all this energy up to go through catalyst stage and then for their insect stage. So if you have a moth caterpillar, it has to give enough energy to survive it through the catalyst and also being a moth, because some moths have having no mouth at all. All the energy in the body was there from when they ate a caterpillar. My caterpillars just devour. I don't like it. They destroy my tomato plants, you know, but I know why now, because they got to get enough energy to survive those transitions.
The caterpillar has more than six legs?
No, the other ones are false legs. They only have six real legs, and the rest of them are just spongy appendages that they grab things. They're called false legs.
Wow.
So caterpillar only has six legs, I can assure you. The other ones are called false legs. So it looks like they've got, you know, six in the front and six in the back, and they're moving, but they're just soft appendages they use to grab the limb, but they're not really legs. So no, they only have six legs, I can assure you. Yep.
I find I have a harder time reasoning not with convergent evolution, which I deeply believe in, that God created these miraculous things. I have a harder time reasoning with vestigial structures, which are kind of useless, either bones or organs in animals and plants, and how these came about, and like, why did God create these things with a kind of like useless, say in the whale, like some of the hip bones that should should be like connected to legs.
Yeah. Well, I would say there that the common plan doesn't mean that something totally disappears, and so there are lots of things like that. In the whale, you will have these little false legs, and occasionally they'll actually get a genetic mutation where the leg will actually stick out of the body, and so you've got this big, huge, 100-foot animal that has a little teeny leg this big that's totally useless. And for that one to be the same thing, the common plan, it is a vertebrate, and by vertebrate it has to have four limbs. Whether those limbs have totally disappeared is another story. You can go the same thing when you look at snakes, and there's legless lizards. There's lizards out there that look just like snake. People say, oh, that's a snake. And I'm like, no, that's a lizard. And I'm like, how can you tell? So, well, his head is different, and he can't dislocate his jaw. And there the legs are completely gone. And so there are both ways. So you have this whale that has these little teeny legs that do nothing, and then you've got this lizard that used to have legs and totally disappeared like a snake. And snakes don't have, leftover legs are completely gone. These lizards don't have things. So you will see that. And so I would say, obviously, it's either two aspects, obviously, of either common plan design. And then, of course, Hugh always tells us before we describe them as being totally useless, we have to totally investigate. So in the human body, obviously, we used to cut out everybody's appendix because it was totally useless. We find now it's an important part of your immune system. The tailbone was a residual, obviously, of having a tail. And we say it's totally useless. Well, now they find out if you didn't have a tailbone, you couldn't sit at your computer screen for more than 15 minutes without being in immense pain. And so before you call something useless, Hugh Aston says you have to totally investigate and say, does it have some other purpose? And it could be, like I said, something left over from God's design and plan. But Hugh always just cautions before you say something's totally useless, you really need to investigate. It was the same with the panda's thumb, was the other classic one that Christians would like to use because they say, oh, this is just some growth out of its wrist, obviously, and it's totally useless, and it's a bad design. And now we know it's the most actually perfect design for stripping bamboo leaves. And it is time for us to end. I'll be up here to answer questions. Mark, could you have your hand up, or no? Were you just telling me I'm over time?
I
want to get to Greg. Yeah, because we're there. Yeah, otherwise I have to run back and stand in the back and tell myself to quit. That'd be ridiculous.
I'll be here for a couple of seconds.
Okay, I will be around for questions. I'll turn my mic off here. But dear Lord, we're so very thankful for animals, Lord. We could have gone on and on about animals and also plants and how you have packed this planet with life is just totally amazing, especially just the huge animals like whales that can be hundreds of tons and hundreds of feet long. It's totally amazing, down to these little teeny animals that we've looked at, Lord. And it's just amazing how you've packed this planet full of life. Even today, scientists are still finding new species hidden out of view and discovered and marveling at them and trying to figure out how they fit in here, Lord. But we know you have a master plan, Lord, just for our life and also for this planet. And we're so very thankful for you packing this planet with the maximum life for the maximum amount of time so that we could have all these resources available for our civilization and to reach people for Christ. And so we're thankful for Hugh Ross and his new studio that he's able to use technology to reach out to more people, Lord, and tell them about the good news of the gospel and your love and your forgiveness in a setting that enlightens their mind and breaks down barriers, which is what our goal is, Lord. Help us to help break down barriers and people to see you as both a wonderful designer, a redeemer, and lover. Amen.